Turn with me to Isaiah chapter 20. If you need a Bible, Bud has Bibles. If you don't have an outline, brother in the fellowship said, hey, it would be really great if we had some kind of outline to work from on Wednesdays. And it took me a couple Wednesdays to carve out the time. We'll see how this one goes. Give me your feedback. Let me know if it was helpful. Let me know what would be more helpful. I just kind of took a shot at laying out the way I think the message might go. Isaiah 20, we're going to look tonight at a very short, very strange chapter. And as we do, let's pause briefly and remind ourselves how we got here. And if you'll permit me, I want to work backward. As we turn to Isaiah 20 tonight, the year is 711 BC, and we'll talk about how we know that in a little bit. 711 BC, that means Isaiah has been prophesying for almost 30 years by this point. People quibble a little bit over exactly when he started, probably 740 BC. Why? Why is he prophesying again? Why did God raise him up? What's the purpose of his ministry? Answer, the Assyrian Empire is on the ascent in the 8th century BC. Syria and Israel lay directly in Assyria's path as Isaiah begins prophesying. Judah is vulnerable. And God's message that he begins speaking to Ahaz and speaks to a number of kings in succession, don't freak out. Initially, don't freak out. Don't be afraid of Syria and Israel. Remember, they were threatening Judah. Look, side with us, align with us against Assyria, or we're going to make you align with us by force. That was back in Isaiah 7. Don't fear Syria and Israel. Don't fear Assyria. Don't freak out. Trust the Lord. Trust that the Lord will preserve and protect and prosper you. Trust that God can deliver you even out of this mess, this conundrum. That was not a new message when Isaiah began speaking it. That's been God's consistent message to Israel as long as there was an Israel, right? So question, how did Judah, the southern part of the divided kingdom of Israel, get to the point where she needed that exhortation again, emphatically, at length? Well, that's a big question. At least part of the answer has to be the division of the kingdom. I mean, in some respects, that had to mark the beginning of the end, the beginning of the downfall, right? Because once Israel was divided into the northern kingdom of Israel, the southern kingdom of Judah, both were weakened, the north more than the south, but both were weakened, weakened politically, economically, militarily, spiritually, certainly. How did they get to the point where they divided? Well, let's go real big picture for a second. Let's pan way out. Exodus happened on or about 1446 BC. And then they did a few laps around the desert, entered into the promised land under Joshua 1405 BC or so. Joshua led for 25 years. I'm doing that from memory. And then 400 years under the judges. By 1050 BC, Israel decides it's time for a king. And so they get Saul. Starting 1018 and in stages up until, let's call it 1000 BC, just to pick a round number, David ascends to the throne. David dies. His son Solomon takes over in 970 BC. 930 BC, Solomon dies. And when Solomon dies, disunity emerges. Jeroboam leads the north in rebellion. Rehoboam tries to consolidate power in the south. But why? Why do things fragment at that point? It seemed like Israel was on the ascent. A little bit of a misstep with Saul. Not God's guy. David was God's guy. And under Solomon, the kingdom expanded, the kingdom was enriched, the kingdom was as militarily strong as it ever has been. So why did it divide? Why did it break apart after Solomon's death? Well, Jeroboam was a rebel and Rehoboam was a knucklehead who didn't listen to his father's advisors. He listened to his buddies, and I heard somebody say, raise taxes, put the foot on the people's throats, and that's good and fine and fine and true. But skip past that, because I think, in fact, I know the seeds of disunity, the beginning of the fragmentation, actually happened when Solomon was alive. Go back to first, keep a finger in Isaiah 20 that we haven't even started reading yet. But while you keep a finger there, go back to 1 Kings chapter 10. We've gestured at this before in our Isaiah study. I want to actually put eyes on it tonight. That's not where I want to be. That's not where I want to be either. 1 Kings chapter 10, picking it up in verse 14. The weight of gold that came to Solomon yearly was 666 talents of gold. And it came from a lot of different places, verse 15. And he had shields, verse 16, and gold this and gold that, verse 17. Moreover, the king made a great throne of ivory and overlaid it with pure gold, verse 18. And the throne was made a certain way, verses 19 and verse 20. Verse 21, all of his drinking vessels were gold, and not one was silver. And verse 22, gold came continually. So verse 23, Solomon surpassed all of the kings of the earth in riches, gold, and wisdom. Verse 24, all the earth sought the presence of Solomon to hear his wisdom, which God had put in his heart. Each man brought his present, silver and gold, garments, armor, spices, horses and mules. Verse 26, Solomon gathered chariots and horsemen. He had a lot of chariots and he had a lot of horsemen because he had a lot of horses. Verse 28, he had horses imported from Egypt and Kiva. Chapter 11, verse 1, King Solomon also loved many foreign women, as well as the daughters of Pharaoh, women from all kinds of different places. Verse 2, from the nations of whom the Lord had said, don't marry these women. But still, verse 2, Solomon clung to these in love. In verse 3, he had 700 wives, princesses, and 300 concubines, and his wives turned away his heart. Pause. We might be tempted to think, well, good on him. Dude had gold, dude had horses. Women, okay, that's maybe not cool, but what's the problem with all of that? He wasn't supposed to. Go back to Deuteronomy 17. You can turn there if you can go there quick, or you can just listen. Keep a finger in 1 Kings 11. We're coming back. But Deuteronomy 17, picking up in verse 14, when you come to the land that the Lord your God is giving you, this is instructions God is giving Moses before they're even in the land. This is what you need to remember. This is what you need to do. When you come to the land and possess it and dwell in it, and say, I'll set a king over me like all of the nations that are around me, because God knows that's inevitable. You may not set a foreigner over you who's not your brother. Verse 16, but he shall not multiply horses for himself, nor cause the people to return to Egypt to multiply horses. For the Lord has said to you, you shall not return that way again. Neither shall he multiply wives for himself, lest his heart turn away. Nor shall he greatly multiply silver and gold for himself. What should he multiply for himself? Verse 18, also it shall be when he sits on the throne of his kingdom that he shall write for himself a copy of this law in a book from the one before the priests, the Levites. And it shall be with him, and he shall read it all the days of his life, that he might learn to fear the Lord his God. Don't multiply horses, don't multiply women, don't multiply gold. In other words, do what? Don't trust in yourself and in your own resources, in human resources, in worldly power. Trust in what? Trust in God. Solomon didn't. He conspicuously and dramatically didn't. Go big or go home. Solomon went huge. And when he went home to the Lord, what was the result? Back to 1 Kings 11. Pick it up in verse 9. The Lord became angry with Solomon because his heart had turned from the Lord God, who had appeared to him twice and commanded him concerning this thing that he shouldn't go after other gods, but he didn't keep what the Lord had commanded. Therefore, the Lord said to Solomon, because you've done this and have not kept my covenant and my statutes, which I've commanded you, I will surely tear the kingdom away from you and give it to your servant. Not in your days, for the sake of your father David, I'll tear it out of the hand of your son. Why did the kingdom divide? Solomon decided to trust in worldly resources and human strength to solve problems. Economic strength, gold. Military strength, horses. Political strength, wives, marriages. He first started pursuing as a way to solidify political alliances. He did all of those things instead of trusting divine strength. God's strength. Why? Why do we do anything that's apart from God? Pride and pleasure. Pride and pleasure. The two things that draw us away to what our best selves know we should be pursuing, to what our right-minded selves know that we should be clinging to. Pride and pleasure, the attraction, the allure to Solomon, just too great. He wouldn't let them go. Why the history lesson, Patrick? Because as we turn to Isaiah 20, finally, it turns out that Solomon's error, his apostasy, wasn't just part of Judah's history. It was very much their current reality. Isaiah 20, verse 1, in the year that Tartan came to Ashdod, when Sargon, the king of Assyria, sent him, and he fought against Ashdod and took it, at the same time the Lord spoke by Isaiah, the son of Amoz. We'll pause there. We said earlier that this is one of the times we know what year it is. We know that it's 711 BC as this is unfolding. How do we know? We know because of what Isaiah just said. This is one of those times, a lot of times in Isaiah, we're left scratching our heads. When exactly are we in history? Are we here? Are we here? And a lot of times we have to settle for, well, it has to be after this, but before this. We know it happens after X, but before Y and Z. But this is one of those every once in a while as we get a concrete reference point. In 712 BC, Ashdod, what's Ashdod? Ashdod is one of the five big cities of Philistia in Isaiah's day. What's Philistia? Philistia is that the region of the Philistines along the Mediterranean. If you think Gaza Strip in our day, you're in the right zip code. Philistia was bigger. Philistia had five major cities in Isaiah's day. Ashdod was one of them. They revolted against Assyria. Assyria had occupied them by this time. Remember, 722 BC, they'd already conquered Syria and Israel. They'd gone south. They'd conquered Philistia. Well, in 712, Ashdod rebels. And Judah naturally wonders, is this an opportunity? Because Judah hadn't been conquered. But they knew that they were in Assyria's sights. They knew that they were on the short list of states that Assyria was going to come against next. But Ashdod's rebelling. Is this an opportunity? Should we join them? And if we join them, is it possible that Egypt would join us? Is this our opportunity to make a stand against the evil empire? Meanwhile, Assyria knows that this is a possibility, knows that they need to squash this rebellion. So just a few months later, in 711 BC, Sargon II, king of Assyria, sends Tartan, one of his key guys, one of his three chief officers, down to personally put down, to squash the uprising in that city. What's interesting about this, for centuries, skeptics would look at this verse and say, see, this is why you can't trust the Bible. This is why you have to understand the Bible is at least 50% myth and fairy tale. There's no such person as Sargon. And it wasn't until I'm doing this from memory, I think the late 19th century, that archaeology caught up with the Bible. And archaeologists said, oh, wait, yeah, there actually is. In fact, there were two, Sargon and Sargon II, because they finally found relics, inscriptions, artifacts that said, yeah, he was a guy. Didn't rule for a long time, but he ruled from 722 to 705 BC and continued the ruthless expansion of his predecessors. And so after the fall of Israel, the northern kingdom of Syria, he's very much planning on attacking his neighbors. He just has to deal with this rebellion thing first. Ashdod and Philistia. And Judah had good reason to believe that as long as they were in the neighborhood putting down Ashdod, they might just zig over a little bit to the east and come against Judah at the same time. Two birds, one stone. Save another trip. And so they were keenly interested. Do we think Egypt might join with us? Is it possible they'd help? Is this our opportunity to make a stand? At which point God weighs in. He's sympathetic to us in our weakness. We sang that a couple minutes ago. Our strength and weakness. God knows our fears. He knows our impulses. He knows our pride and our desire for pleasure. He knows everything about us. And knowing that Judah was freaking out, he has Isaiah communicate to them, not just to the king, but to the people of Judah, don't do that. Stop that. I told you not to freak out about Isaiah and Syria. I said that in a few years they'd amount to nothing. I was right. You saw that happened. Now I'm telling you, don't worry about Assyria. You don't need to enter into alliances with other nations. I've got this, God says. Continuing in verse 2, the Lord spoke by Isaiah, the son of Amos, saying, go and remove the sackcloth from your body and take your sandals off your feet. And he did so, walking naked and barefoot. This is how God chose to communicate that message. He does that sometimes, right? When he knows words are going to fail, sometimes he has a prophet walk out a really dramatic object lesson. Hosea, God said, marry a prostitute and give your children really humiliating names. Jeremiah, preach with a yoke around your neck. Ezekiel, every time you turn around, Ezekiel's living out an object lesson. Eat a scroll. Build a diorama of Jerusalem out of clay. Lay on your side for 390 days. Shave your head. Don't mourn your wife's death. Isaiah, I want you to walk around barefoot and naked for 3 years. Now, commentators like to dig into this and say, wait, it's not what it sounds like. Naked doesn't have to mean stark naked. The Hebrew idea of naked just meant he didn't have a robe, he didn't have a tunic on, he was walking around in his skivvies. Okay, I think that's a distinction more than a difference, but that's fine. And they'll tell you, well, 3 years doesn't have to mean 36 months. Could have been 14 months because of the Hebrew way of reckoning time. If something started in December of 2020, continued all through 2021 into January of 2022, they would say, well, that happened over 3 years. It started in 2020 and ended in 2022. That's 3 years in Hebrew reckoning. Okay, fine. That doesn't really change the point, though, does it? What was the point? Verse 3, the Lord said, here's the point, just as my servant Isaiah has walked naked and barefoot 3 years for a sign and a wonder against Egypt and Ethiopia, so shall the king of Assyria lead away the Egyptians as prisoners and the Ethiopians as captive, young and old, naked and barefoot, with their buttocks uncovered to the shame of Egypt. What was the point of the exercise? God tells us the point was to express dramatically, vividly to Judah, you're thinking of going to Egypt for help. Egypt with its fancy new Ethiopian leaders. We talked about that last week. Egypt and Ethiopia united together, and you're thinking that nation might help you stand against the Assyrians, except here's what I need to tell you is going to happen to Egypt and Ethiopia at the hands of the Assyrians. They're going to be led away naked and barefoot into captivity. What you saw Isaiah doing, that's going to be what the Egyptians and the Ethiopians are going to be doing. And that was typical for the Assyrians. They would march prisoners away barefoot. Why barefoot? If the terrain is rocky, which it was, really hard to fight, really hard to run when you don't have anything protecting your feet from the rocks. The other thing that Assyria would do is not only move people, they would move large numbers of people to homogenize the populations of the cultures that they conquered, to war with any sense of national identity. We'll take people from country A and move them to country B. People from country B, move them to country C. People from country C, move them to country D. We're going to just keep mixing them around so that they don't remember their roots, so that there's no critical mass to rally an insurrection. Hey, remember where we came from. Remember who we are. Their hope was that people would forget where they came from and forget who they were. And as they marched them, barefoot, which was helpless, long distances to homogenize them, they would also humiliate them as much as possible. Strip them naked, march them in the street, so that everyone would see this is what happens when you go up against the Assyrians. Think twice before you rebel against us. And archaeologists have found all manner of wall reliefs. That was one of the mediums of art in the day. Art carved into walls, sculpture carved into walls, picturing exactly this. Assyrian masters leading prisoners on foot and in carts in chains. If you look up Assyrian Empire, if you Google that, one of the images that's guaranteed to come up will be an image of that. And history tells us in 671 BC, this is exactly what happened. That Egypt and Ethiopia were in fact led away captive. 671 BC, Esarhaddon, who was then king of Assyria, conquered Egypt, fulfilling this prophecy just 40 years after it was spoken. And the lesson to Judah, verse 5, be afraid. I'm sorry, then they shall be afraid and ashamed of Ethiopia, their expectation, and Egypt their glory. And the inhabitant of this territory, Judah, will say in that day, surely such is our expectation, wherever we flee to help, to be delivered from the king of Assyria, how shall we escape? God's point, this is what's going to happen. You're thinking of turning to Egypt for help. You're thinking of looking to Ethiopia to deliver you. It's not going to happen. In fact, the thing that you're afraid is going to happen to you is going to happen to Egypt, is going to happen to Ethiopia. They're going to be conquered. They're going to be humiliated. They're going to lose their sovereignty. They're going to lose their territory. They're going to lose their national identity. It's going to happen to them. It's going to happen to anyone that you seek to align yourself with. Don't go there. Then where should we go? Let me repeat the lesson, God is saying. Had this conversation with Moses. Had this conversation with David. Had this conversation with Solomon a couple times. I'm the Lord your God. Trust me. What does Judah do? If you don't know, you can guess. But flip over to Isaiah 30 so that you don't have to wait in suspense. Not going to unpack the whole thing. We're just going to read a few verses. Isaiah 30, woe to the rebellious children, says the Lord. Well, that doesn't sound good. Who take counsel but not of me, who devise plans but not of my spirit, that they might add sin to sin, who walk to go down to Egypt. Haven't asked my advice. They walk to go down to Egypt to strengthen themselves in the strength of Pharaoh and to trust in the shadow of Egypt. Therefore the strength of Pharaoh shall be your shame, and trust in the shadow of Egypt shall be your humiliation. You're doing the thing I said not to do. You're going to get the thing I said you were going to get. For his princes were at Zoan, and his ambassadors came to Hanes. They were all ashamed of a people who could not benefit them or be help or benefit, but a shame and also a reproach. Don't trust in men, God said. Don't trust in nations. Don't trust in earthly powers. Trust me. Judah did not. They would not. Look down at verse 15, still chapter 30. For thus says the Lord your God, the Holy One of Israel, in returning and rest you shall be saved. In quietness and confidence shall be your strength. Be still and know that I am God and everything will be okay. But you would not. And you said, no, for we will flee on what? Horses. Therefore, yeah, you're going to flee. You said, we'll ride on swift horses. Those who chase you are going to be even swifter. Not the Assyrians, the Babylonians. The Assyrians turned out to be yet another warning. We've talked about this in 701 BC. God gives them another opportunity to turn back. But the Babylonians, look back at verse 12. The Babylonians are going to have their way with Judah. Why? Verse 12, because you despise this word and trust in oppression and perversity and rely on them. Other nations. Therefore, this iniquity shall be to you like a breach ready to fall, a bulge in a high wall whose breaking comes suddenly in an instant. And he shall break it like the breaking of the potter's vessel, which is broken in pieces. He shall not spare, so there shall not be found among its fragments a shard to take fire from the hearth or to take water from the cistern. Trust me, God said. Depend on me, he pleaded. Wait on me, he instructed. Rest in me, he begged. Because the alternative is to be broken by me. He made clear again and again and again. What about us? I found it was weird the things that you accidentally find. 10 years ago or so, we had a worship team visit here. It was a friend's brother's. He had recorded an album. He was touring behind the album. They came through here, and he had a couple young musicians with him. And I happened to find the album today while I was looking for something else is why I'm thinking of this. But one of those young, after the message, I hear the young guys talking, and they didn't know I was there. I was coming around a corner, but they were saying, you know, what is with pastors? They can't just read the Bible. You know, they can't just get to the end of a passage without saying, well, what does this have to do with us? What's their problem? Well, the problem is if we don't ask the question, then this is just history class. And if we don't ask the question, we're ignoring God who says these things are written for you. These things are useful for you. These things are written for your understanding, not just of the past, but of our present and our future. We'd like to duck the application. Because we have a hard time with it, don't we? The waiting, the trusting, the believing. We got our own ideas of what's good. We're usually pretty sure what we want the answer to be. Job opportunity, spouse, ministry. We know what we want. We know what things should be, what we think makes sense, what's obviously best. And so we say, God, I've got this. I'll holler the next time I don't know what to do, but this one I've got. I really like my answer. I'm not going to trade it for what's behind door number two. Besides, I'm an American. It's my job to pull myself up by my own bootstraps, make my own way, supply my own answers. Another way our pride manifests itself, I had this conversation with somebody recently. I said, well, have you prayed about it? No. What's an interesting answer? How come? Well, I don't want to be needy. I don't want to always be whining to God. And I said, is God your father? Yeah. Is God your God's your father and we're his children, right? And I know this person takes care of children on occasion. I said, do you get frustrated with one of the small children that you take care of cries? Whines, they need to be changed, they need food. I mean, babies, what's with them? They cry and they cry and they cry. It's just need, need, need. And she looks at me, she said, but they're babies. I said, right, so are we. We're children. And God doesn't get mad at us when we come to him in need any more than we get mad at infants. He wants us to come to him. Look at how hard he's working trying to convey to us his deep desire that we would come to him and avoid pain and avoid heartache and avoid mistakes. But still, we come up with reasons not to trust, not to depend, not to rest, and they all come from pride. God's response to our need is always, I've got a plan. Just wait. I've got the answer. If you'll listen. I know what to do. If you'll trust me. God says to us, I have a plan, and it's better than your plan. I know why you think the Egyptians is a good idea, but trust me, it's not. I've got a better plan. God says to us, I'll make a way. I know that you don't see any way forward, but I can make one, and it'll be better than your way. You striving tonight? In anything? If you're like me, you're slow to answer, because a lot of times I realize after the fact I was striving and I didn't even know it. A lot of times when I'm striving with the Lord, I have no idea that's what's going on, because I'm too busy striving, struggling, assuming that this burden is mine to carry, that I don't stop and ask the question, God, what do you have for me? God, what do you know is best? Because I'm too busy trying to make something happen. I don't stop and ask, is it the right something? Is it the right timing? Because the right something and the wrong timing is the wrong something. And if we continue in that mode, struggling and striving and not stopping and asking and listening and waiting, God might have to do something really dramatic to get our attention. Might have to send a naked prophet. Okay, maybe not. But he'll send something, won't he? Hasn't God at least once in your life allowed you to experience a disruption, a loss, a threat, some sort of discontinuity that made you say, okay, wait a minute. I don't know anything right now. I have to shake the Etch-a-Sketch and start from a blank screen, because Everything I thought I knew just blew up. God's done it with me a bunch of times. He's done it with health stuff. 14, 15 years ago, whenever it was, I got pneumonia for the first time. God said, okay, you wouldn't stop, you wouldn't slow down and listen. I'm going to make you slow down. In fact, you're not going to get out of bed here for a little bit because we have some conversations that we need to catch up on. Family things or church family things, relationships. You say, God, I didn't see that coming. What happened? How did that happen? Where did that come from? And God said, yeah, been wanting to talk to you about that. Ministry things. And sometimes it's not bad. Sometimes it's good. Half a dozen times or so, someone has reached out and said, hey, here's a ministry opportunity that you weren't looking for or thinking about. Okay, I don't know what to do with this. God, what do I do with this? And God said, we'll talk about that in a moment, but we have to talk about some other things first, now that I have your attention. God, if we're not seeking him the way that we should, has a lot of levers he can pull. There's a lot of things he can orchestrate to bring us to a point of feeling like we're over our head or out of our depth, punching above our weight class. But how much better is it that we go to God before those disruptions enter our lives? Before there's a naked prophet marching around getting our attention? How much better when we say, God, what are your ways? What is your will? What do you have? Let's take a couple moments tonight and just ask that question. Because as soon as we leave this room, the busyness and the next thing and the to-do list and the everything is going to set in. Let's take a couple moments as Hector comes back up. Lord, where am I missing it? Lord, where am I not hearing you? Lord, where am I not asking you? Lord, where am I not resting in you, waiting on you, trusting you?